Hey, my name is Jorge Cervantes, and this is my dope history.
Jorge Cervantes is known as a prolific cannabis author around the world, but his story began in a small rural town on the West Coast. It was in this conservative environment that he was exposed to cannabis, and it was there that he took his first toke. Like many kids raised in the 50s and 60s, he was taught many of the common lies about cannabis, and having experienced otherwise, the lens through which he viewed things shifted. Jorge went abroad to study at a young age. It was during this time that he discovered cannabis from different regions of the world. He was around to see the outlaw culture transform from a loose and unorganized network into the highly organized business world of the Netherlands seed banks.
In the early years, I grew up in a small town, Ontario, Oregon, and is a farming community, high desert, about 2,100 feet above sea level, you know. Farmers, mainly Republicans. My father was chairman of the Democratic Central Committee there, so there's a back and forth there. But it was fairly sheltered, real safe place to grow up, and you could do anything you wanted. It was all right. And then puberty hit, and then, man, there's all these girls around. They just were great. And and then it was kind of like, about that time, I was born in 1953, so the 60s, the Beatles were in, the Rolling Stones were in, rock and roll came, and puberty hit, and it's like, geez, oh, that's when, like, kind of like, was crazy times. We all went out in my car. There was four of us. One of my buddies got a lid, like a three-finger lid of Mexican dirt weed. And I got one of my dad's old pipes, you know, like a tobacco pipe. And we all went on, just cruised around and puffed it because there wasn't any place to go. Nobody had a house to go to. You had a car. And in the car, well, that was about it. But there was four of us. And we just smoked and smoked and smoked that thing. I mean, we smoked the whole ounce between four of us. And finally, I got high. I mean, I like just super high. And it was just a light, wonderful feeling. And it was like I was in a movie and I was watching myself in the movie, participating, but still at the same time in the third part. Never been there before. That's pretty fun, but still cognizant of everything. And that was fine. So, you know, quite, I thought, boy, this, I'd heard lectures about this horrid drug. And I thought, well, those guys just don't know what they're talking about. And it really turned me around like pretty fast. Or, I mean, right then, because, you know, you'd hear like hard line stuff. And there wouldn't be any details to back it up. There'd just be hardline sayings, like, believe me, when it starts like that. Those are hard, but not facts. And those people really don't know what they're talking about. And the other ones that actually should know what they're talking about, they haven't done their homework or they haven't researched anything. They really haven't. But two at the time, I got to give them this. There wasn't a lot of good information available. How the whole drug war started was pretty much buried and only paid attention to by a few people. It didn't really hit mainstream media. It wasn't a common thing. So, and media was, well, it was a lot harder to get a hold of information then too. Different times, you know. but you had to stay really conservative because that's the way things were. So I went to a year in community college, and then I went to Spain, and I went to Valencia to make a year in school because it was a good deal, and I had a lot more freedoms. Seriously, I had a lot more freedoms here at that time, even under a dictator, than I had in my own home and my own town. And then I went back to my hometown, and it was like pretty boring and stuff, but I didn't have any money left. So I went to another year of community college, finished other stuff. And then I went to school in Mexico. I went to University of Americas. Yeah. And that was quite a different thing because, you know, you got Iberian Peninsula over here, Europe, and then you got Mexico over here. And wow, man, they're way different. And school's way different and everything. But it was a good school southeast of Puebla. Puebla's a state, you know, they have like the United States of Mexico, they call it. I think I was there two days. I didn't make three. I had already bought a kilo of cannabis. I had some great dope. it was really good. Well, you know, it had seeds and stuff, but gosh, we could get some great dope. We could get sinsemilla, but that wasn't like as common. Most of it had seeds in it, but we could get stuff. And like I had several friends that were dealing, just kind of doing small stuff. But everybody had kilos, you know, because you got branches and you got seeds. So over half of it's gone. And then stuff falls on the floor and shit, you know, so you roll those big joints, like those great big finger joints. And then we all had like a smoking stone or a roach clip. Nobody knew what a filter was. Everybody had burned mustaches from smoking. God, we had Mexican dope. And then that was that Mexican dirt weed most people had. And then after that, Colombian came, you know, after the Emerald market crash when they deregulated it. Everybody starts growing cannabis there. They started exporting it. They were growing a bit, but they were exporting it then, yeah. And it was just better. And then after that, it was homegrown, but nobody could tell males from females. And nobody knew when to pick it or anything, so it was always leafy. And then there was Rainbow. That was Mexican dope, Colombian dope, and homegrown. And it was like three colors. That's Rainbow. There was sinsemilla too, you know, that started. There was a book with sinsemilla. It was a big deal. And that was in the 70s, late 70s, I think. But a lot of other people didn't know male from female. Sometimes they would pick them. Sometimes they wouldn't, or there'd be rogue stuff. And most of the seeds were bad. Nobody had done a lot of domestication of seeds or work with genetics. But there was a few people like Dave Watson, you know, had made haze early on. And then Mel Frank had done a bunch of stuff with Afghanis. And then early 80s, really, Neville started putting stuff together because it came together right about that time. And kind of like everybody kind of knew each other, except a lot of people just like were hiding. Yeah, because it's really weird how the seed stuff grew. Because there was all these little, like you could call, you know, autonomous areas that would have different seeds and different varieties. And once in a while they get moved for, you know, across the nation. But there'd be these nucleuses of different stuff all over the place. And then that all was concentrated in the Netherlands. And then later it spread out to Vancouver. And that was, you know, really thanks to Mark Emery. I mean, he was really the guy that pushed all of that, you know. But that was the seed stuff, and that changed everything. You know, people really got into it a lot more. And then, too, the internet came in, and the forums were really big. There used to be overgrow.com. That was great. And that was out of like a suburb in Toronto. And people could make private deals in the chat section, you know, like back and forth privately. And then publicly they could say other things, you know, but there was basically there was only censorship? Asshole censorship. Somebody's an asshole, they don't like it. But that was about it, yeah, you know. Or wanker censorship. Yeah, that's better. Wanker.
Jorge Cervantes has authored 50 books and DVDs in 12 languages, and his marijuana horticulture handbook is widely known as the Grow Bible. He started by self-publishing his work, and from there was able to sign with professional printers who could also handle distribution. Although his work had been translated to dozens of languages, there were many countries where his books were banned. That didn't stop him from trying to ship his work, but it didn't always reach the final destination. There were other risks associated with being an author of books detailing the methods of growing this illegal crop. In 1989, Operation Green Merchant swept the nation, and these types of materials and those providing them were targeted. Over his many years documenting thousands of grow rooms, Jorge has seen the technology advance from using traditional film to digital cameras. But did you know Jorge Cervantes has published grow books under another name?
I'd moved back to Portland, Oregon. I'd been growing for a couple of years, and I was out of school, or I was out of university, so fuck, all I knew how to do was, I didn't study plants, but I liked them a lot. I had a garden business up in Portland. I was cutting trees. You cut things up there because there's a lot of trees. Or you just, things grow, so you cut them. Like in Seattle, you cut them more than make them grow. And then, you know, I started growing in the basement, and it seemed like a pretty good deal. And so I was growing. I thought, you know, God, I've been in this for a few years. Like I go for 8 months, 12, 14 months, and then there'd be a problem. You lose all your money for some reason, right? So because it was kind of like you have problems, you know, don't need to talk about those. Fuck it. Anyway, indoor growing got to be a big thing, and it was like just a few people were into it. A few more and more all the time, but a lot of bikers dominated. Especially at first, a few other people, but it was always kind of a close thing. I thought, man, there's just not enough information. And there was one guy, Steve Murphy. He's a good buddy too, real good guy. He has the indoor sun shop over there in Ballard. Anyway, they have 50-year anniversary this year. I saw him this summer. Yeah, it was great. But he had How to Grow the Finest Marijuana Indoors. That's right. But he changed his name, Murphy Stevens. I can say all this stuff now. You couldn't say it before. So. But anyway, it was good enough back then. You just change the two names around and you're okay. It doesn't work like that now. So anyway, the book was lacking. It didn't say enough. It wasn't direct enough. So one of the jobs I had was this survey research thing. So a job. So I thought, well, I know a bunch about growing, but I don't know enough. So I made this survey, like 10 questions, and got about 100 people to fill it out. Pretty much I had to go ask them all the questions and then fill it out. No name, nothing. And then, so I wrote a book after that because computers just came out. You know, I could get a computer and it was reasonable price, and then you could get it typeset and shit. And then I fucking printed it. You know, on a 1250 multi-list press. Yeah. It had paper plates, so they were cheap. I rented time on the press after hours at a print shop. Yeah. Just paid expenses. Yeah, it was great. But we had to fucking collate all those papers and stuff. That was a lot of work. But I sold 6,000 copies the first year because I went out and sold them, you know, to everybody at grow stores. And then, and head shops, but not long after that, they started the RICO laws and shit. So, and a lot of people didn't want them because they said it tied them to that stuff. Well, fucking, here's a story about like Steve and his buddy Vito. they had those books, and this was like late 70s, because my first book came out in 83. But they got in the car and filled it full of a bunch of books and drove down the coast and sold them all at the head shops and stuff. And then fucking Vito, he started Western Pipeline. Western Pipeline is a book distribution company, and they grew super fast. But it all started because him and Steve drove down south, and he goes, God, this book selling's a good deal. And everybody was into it. It was a huge company. Yeah, and then it went up, and then they had accounting problems. Yeah, that's right. So Steve really did kind of blaze the way, I mean, for sure. And then another guy I met, Bill Drake, he lives in Portland, Oregon. Now, he used to live in Texas for a long time. I've been communicating with him for a while. But he wrote Cannabis Cultivator's Handbook or Marijuana Cultivator's Handbook. It's green. It's about this big. But he got it printed in Eugene, Oregon when he lived there. And it was more an outdoor book. Yeah, that was the first one I'd ever read before I got to the Northwest, actually. Yeah. Wow, old stuff. But I got to meet him, and we hung out and stuff. Yeah, that's great. He lives in Portland. I can't believe it. Yeah. But anyway, the book started selling, and then the next year I got printed at a, you know, commercial company, and they have put a spine on it. And I don't know if I have any of those old ones. I got them, but I just don't know if I can find them real quick. The Dutch ones. Because that was my first foreign edition, was the Dutch one, and it started 88. And that did, Netherlands isn't very big in the cannabis growers market. It's just, you know, a fraction of the puffers market, right? So it's still a bestseller. They were calling it a bestseller. It sold like 2,000 copies the first year, and which was, for Netherlands, a heck of a lot. Yeah, everybody had it. It was great. No, I don't think about most of this stuff all the time. I mean, very, very often, to be honest. In fact, I had no idea I'd publish 50 books. I thought it was like 34, 35, something like that. I didn't really pay attention. And then I sat down, got them all together, and thought about the years. And oh, man, there's over 50 of the things, you know. A lot of foreign editions, you know, German, French, Dutch, Italian, Russian, Japanese, for sure, Spanish. That was, you know, a big one. Yeah, there's quite a few of them. We had problems selling books to the grow stores, the hydroponic stores, because they couldn't carry a cannabis book, or they were afraid to, because it would tie them into racketeering law. So what I did is I made a parallel series of books that were straight. I just changed a few things. But it's kind of funny with cannabis, you know, I mean, it's got a male and a female plant. It's a small group of plants, and it's also photoperiodic reactive, right? So there's a smaller group of plants that fits both of those categories. But, you know, it seemed to work. I can do all this stuff. And it was kind of funny. But yeah, I did quite a few of those. I did a series. I did a gardening indoors series, a thick one. And it's interesting because all of the growth stores, all of the employees read my books, because it's basically a blueprint to growing indoors. It had all of the details, everything in real, straightforward, honest manner, right? So everything we knew at the time was there. So everybody read it, and the straight one too. So it was really a good deal. And then I did four little books. They did okay. Yeah, they did okay. They were specific subjects. There was a rock wool, a CO2, a HID light, and cuttings. Yeah. And they were like smaller subjects. But, you know, they did actually pretty well. I didn't translate any of those. yeah, they weren't good for the other markets. Did a hydroponics book, quite a few stuff. Yeah, but straight ones I'm talking about. Yeah, and then all the books in French had to be straight too for their market, because it's a unique market, France. There's just a lot of barriers. And then came in 1989 was a green merchant. It was like 120 people went to jail, got arrested, went to jail. And they raided stores in like 42, 44 states, something like that. And it was a coordinated effort by the DEA. Yeah, I went out of business, and oh man, yeah, that was, oh, those were hard times. And then kind of like took it easy for about like 3 years. 3 years, yeah. And a bunch of people like David Idle from Chicago Indoor, he got popped, and then he also had the Chicago News sitting in his parking lot talking all the time. And he was harassed. I remember I was over at his house and we were sitting in his basement there watching videos of him getting harassed. And I thought, okay. You know, I thought, David, man, how do you put up with this? He says, well, I just try not to think about it. You know, I mean, I just think about other stuff. And I thought, wow. And so that I thought, I can do that. Man, David can do that. I can do that. And then that's when I kind of like came back, you know, and started publishing again and updated books. Yeah, updated marijuana horticulture. And then that was like 93. And then I started going to Canada and then Amsterdam too. And then later moved to BC and then was there for a year and a half. And then moved to Amsterdam. Everybody had to be kind of quiet back then, too. Because, you know, if you're from America, you go, or from the United States, because Canadians are actually from North America, too. But, man, you're just spooked all the time. <You know? laughs> Tread lightly. Even after, I mean, I've been there for a while, and you still be quite careful, you know, about everything. Yeah, but it was a good time back then, gosh. And there was so many growers, too. And that's when I started writing again. I'd written some in the first for High Times, and that's when I got a monthly call. Yeah, I sent an article in every month. You had to do everything with film back then, right? Because you could shoot 36 pages. Well, usually I shoot, like, what's it, 96 pictures at a grow. Yeah, but it was all on film, you know, color film, always Fuji film, had better greens. Yeah, yeah. And, oh, printing problems, censorship problems. Garden writers censored me every time I'd enter. I had to remind them, you know, of a disclaimer in my books. And also, it's a free fucking country, you know, give it up, guys. They'd probably be like that with orchid growers. Those are the worst. And then there's Australia, fucking Australia. I got books down there. We were sending them in, and then we got redline. They redlined us. That means they put a red line on your box, and that means they open it. So they open it, and they go, dope books. And then so after that, we started putting Bibles on it, and that worked for a while. And then it didn't work, and then we got redlined again. And then they sent me a nasty letter again. So I called up my distributor there. He's pretty smart. He goes, I said, well, how are you going to deal with this? And he goes, well, I found out how much their budget is, first thing, and then we're just going to run them out of money. Took him 3 years. 3 years. We had him in for three more years. Yeah, yeah. But it just, you know, it's just been a struggle. I mean, it's And then there was the bikers. I'm not going to say. But they copied an edition too. And I called the guys up and they told me to come over and talk to them. And so I decided not to. So it's just, you know, it's just like difficult stuff. And then we get on the theft list. Because everybody's stealing because they're afraid to buy them during Prohibition. That is weird. So then they get on the theft list, and then they put them behind, and so you have to get a key to open them up, and then you have to buy them, and then so the sales slow down. Yeah, yeah. And it used to be we couldn't get them up into Canada, and I got to thank Mark Emery for that. Yeah, they used to just, I'd send them up there, I'd try a bunch of stuff, and they'd always get them, and they just beat them up and send them back, you know, make COD, damn it.
Vancouver, BC sits just an hour north of the United States. It has an international airport, and it was a popular refuge for cannabis entrepreneurs in the mid-90s. Mark Emery openly had his cannabis lounge, and the authorities were rather tolerant of cannabis-related activity at the time. The underground world was full of interesting characters in those days. Somewhere in the mix fit people like Jorge Cervantes, Reader Steve, and a handful of others. Lower East Hastings was the spot much of the underground activity transpired. Coincidentally, it also happened to be the place where Jorge shot his first video series for High Times. Vancouver was a hotbed in 95 and 96, and in this next piece, Jorge gives us a taste of that era.
You know, I was up there in Canada. I lived up there for about a year and a half in Burnaby, right next to Vancouver. Yeah, I'd go down there to Lower East Hastings. Mark Emery had a store there. The bank was on the corner. You know, it used to be the tallest building in the British Empire in 1901 or something. That bank over there. Somebody had bought it, and some growers had bought it or something. I don't know, but we had access to it. That's where we filmed the video, my first video with High Times, the Ultimate Grow video. And then when we were filming it, Mark Emery got popped. The DEA came, the RCMP, everybody. So we just all went out the back door because we thought, well, we better not hang out over there. We were watching for a while and then thought, those guys are starting to look around. We better leave. So we left. But it was like pretty loose then, you know. I mean, we weren't doing anything illegal, but it's, you know, sometimes you just don't hang around. You should see them do a bust. They knock on the door. They don't have a bludgeon to break the door open. They just wait. Or that's what they used to do. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that was a long time ago. Yeah, they wait, they do surveillance and stuff. Yeah, they weren't bothering anybody. I mean, it went for a long time, and everybody was growing up there. It was pretty, I went one time, you know, Richmond's up there, you know, it's a big flat area out there. It was a real low cloud cover one night. And what happened was there's so many people that were venting out their chimneys. I saw like no less than a dozen lights shining up on this low cloud cover everywhere. It's just like, you go outside, look around, it's like, oh, that was just where I was at. Where they had a light too. They had their own light. And people were smuggling too. There was a lot of smuggling. There was like, they'd do a runner. There was another guy. Oh, yeah. He was growing right on Zero Avenue. That's the border. You go on the one side, you go on the downside, well, that's the United States. You go on this side, it's Canada. But, you know, it's like there's fields and stuff, you know, it's people's back, or well, not their backyard, but it's a field, there's a road, you know, zero road, and then it's the border. That's what it is. And then the bikers, too, the bikers are up there, you know, the Hells Angels. Hells Angels have a big presence there. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's also Asian gangs there. It's just the lay of the land. That's kind of what you got to put up with, or that's what's going on. You know? And so anyway, the time in Canada, I'm just thinking back, gosh, I wrote the articles for High Times, hung out there, visited gardens, made quite a few friends. Gosh, yeah, I haven't. In fact, I saw Kelly. I saw him a couple years ago in Portland. Kelly Zastowny from, he had Western Water Farms. I don't know what he has now. He's always been distributing, big distributor there. Yeah, he's always fun to hang out with. And also Breeder Steve was up there back then. They had that place up on Indian Arm. It's right on the water. You could go, scuba diving. Yeah. Yeah, and that was a great house. It was right on the water. The cops would come by with the big spotlights. Spotlight the house. They used to do that. Yeah, that was old times. But those guys, yeah, Steve and his buddy ate an ounce. They made like a big batch of brownies, and it had an ounce or two in it. They ate the whole thing. And then went on a hike, and about, 45 minutes later, they were pretty blasted. So they decided to turn around. One of them made it in the house, and the other one didn't. You know, and it's always raining up there. So, and it was like everything was going on in BC when I was there. It was like 96. And then, yeah, and then Amsterdam, I was there for a year and a half, almost not two. And Amsterdam was a cool place because everybody was going from BC to Amsterdam to get seeds. That's when the seed market was like really taking off because there wasn't a good supply of seeds in BC. Yeah, and they were bringing them over and then shipping them back to the US. A lot of people were driving up across the border. That was before terrorism hit and stuff. Yeah, it was just a whole different world. Yeah. Old times.
Not many people have personally seen the cannabis culture and cultivation on such a global scale as Jorge Cervantes. His adventures have brought him to 5 continents, traveling extensively in North America, Latin America, Western Europe, and Australia. There are many similarities and just as many differences in the way this plant has been cultivated and revered. Jorge continues to span the globe, observing as well as advising cultivators of all levels. And for the next few minutes, he offers his insights to different areas of the world.
So I was in Colombia for a while. A few years ago, I spent about 4 months mainly in the West, in Cali and Valle de Cauca and Medellin. I was there for a while. I did a few things there in Bogota. I really don't know. And Cartagena de Indias, you know, everybody knows Cartagena. Yeah, I was up there for a while. That was, it's just too hot up there. It's just too hot. It's pure tropic, you know. Yeah, they had the biggest fort in South America. And it was also the biggest slave port in both of the Americas. So a real interesting place. The harbor there is real interesting. Yeah. Yeah, they had, you know, different ways to defend it. It took forever for them. And they had a big swamp behind it. Everything's different there. It's a whole different world. Yeah. You've got the best geography. That's where the Andes split in two, you know. And then the whole big part of the eastern part is selva, you know, jungle. And there's, you know, a lot of people into growing cannabis there. It's, a lot of companies went there. And it's legal. You can grow up to 20 plants there. Everybody says, grow 19, right? But, yeah, you can grow that many at home. But they don't really have a cannabis kind of a culture thing at all. You don't see a lot of people puffing it. You just don't. They just don't have that in the nature of the culture. Yeah, it's different. Same with Peru. You know, more so in Mexico is more of a cannabis culture, but that's, I think, a lot of influence directly from the U.S. But I just didn't see that big of a influence. And Chile and Argentina, they're different. They're different. They have a bigger influence, yeah, of cannabis, yeah. They have a big fair in Chile every year. Yeah, and South America, it's all over the place. Stuff just moves slow there. Yeah. I hung out for a couple weeks up there in El Valle de Cauca, and that's where they grow, like, literally tons of cannabis, like tons and tons, yeah. And we cruised around. I got this guy, Moreno, and he borrowed a motorcycle, but the battery didn't work, so he had to run it to get it started. But we cruised all over the place on that baby. Yeah, and oh boy, I mean, there'd either be coca plants or cannabis, anything that was cultivated. And it was pretty much in that area, they didn't grow so much coffee, but other places, but it's kind of like a commodity there because it's on Indian reservation and it's a confederation of tribes. So they can grow cannabis there and they can also grow coca there. Then they sell it to the mafia because they can't get it off of there. And then everybody gets their palms greased. Yeah. But they were selling it for, like, when I was there, $7 US a pound. And it's okay. It's about 8 to 12%. And most of it's moving to Brazil because it's way better than the Paraguay dope. Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, but they just weren't getting anything for it, you know. But it's kind of like a commodity because they sell coca leaves or they sell coffee or they sell cannabis, but they're about the same price. They're doing the same thing. The Colombians do the same things always. Like for coffee, they form a cartel. They're the funnel where everything goes through and they'll own the land and stuff. They do it for sugar, do it for coffee, they do it for cocaine. Now they do it for cannabis. You know, it's like, and then it's like some people get paid more than others. but that's all kind of like over now. Because the United States, it's legal in so many different states that it's not really an issue. And, you know, they've got so many fairs going on. And then it's legitimate in so many places. The whole profile's changed. It used to be, you know, a small group of people. But that's kind of like you're on the fringe of the sleazy area. That's where you have to go, you know, at that time. Yeah, at that time, you know, and that's the way it is. For years, it's been like that. It's been like that here in Europe, too. Yeah, yeah. They keep us out at Cornelia here at Spanibus because because that's the, well, that's the best place to be. And it's like, you know, a suburb outside of town in an industrial area. Yeah, that's where the fair is. And it works great, you know? Yeah, it works great. Yeah, and it was the same in Netherlands. Most places, except for Switzerland and Austria. Yeah. The other fairs, I'm not sure. Because there's one in Czech Republic. Yeah, yeah. But Cannatrade in Switzerland and... Yeah, anyway, they let you hang out downtown. Or in a real nice place, yeah. To go back to Czech Republic, they're going to follow Germany's lead. They're like that with Germany. And so whatever Germany does, they're probably going to do. And they've been pretty loose about stuff. See, the drug war never reached those guys. And so then I was like, what the fuck's that? They don't have any brainwashing. So it's not an issue to them. The other countries, Hungary, a bunch of guys show up from Hungary at the Austria Fair. It's like kind of like a whole different drainage and different history and stuff over there. So you get different guys that come over, and it's not as far to drive either. I was up at a fair there earlier this year. In Amsterdam, it was Green Tech. It used to be NTV. It's the big horticultural fair up there, big greenhouse fair. Oh, tons. It's huge. And we have our own cannabis section now. It's like, and before it was like, kind of like hard. They weren't so nice, but now they are. Everybody's really nice. It's great. It's pretty amazing, all of the stuff they've done. And they stick together too, Dutch guys. I've got quite a few Dutch friends. And they got kind of like a group, you know. They just stick together. Be like the Basque guys here. The Basque guys stick together. Yeah. But the Dutch, definitely. Yeah.
Jorge has seen the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to grow rooms and design. Over his long career, he has had too many close calls with disaster, and he's also had the fear of jail hanging over his head the whole time. Now, with legal markets, he's able to enjoy the freedom that it brings. He's surfed the plethora of websites offering cannabis cultivation information, and he was also able to grow at home without worry of losing all of his possessions. Jorge Cervantes has coached thousands of growers to a successful harvest, and his work will continue to educate and inspire long into the future. We've all had great moments with cannabis, and Jorge is no different.
Best was, maybe the first time I got high, you know, it was so pleasant and memorable. Or maybe when I smoked that haze. Neville gave me some haze one time. I was going to Amsterdam, so he gave me a nice big branch of it. And I smoked that, and it was just so great. That lasted about a week. The effects, it was minty, piney kind of a flavor, as I remember, but real aromatic, and it had, you just kept getting higher. But you're still crystal clear, but it didn't like level out. It was really nice. And, you know, and then you smoke some, and you wouldn't want to smoke it for a while because it was enough. That was really good. Probably one of those two. Yeah. Bad experience. Let me think. Probably the worst, I don't know, that one's kind of like a cumulative thing. And that's the fear of going to prison. That was just in my mind for so many years. It's just hard to get over sometimes. But, you know, I mean, that was there. During Green Merchant, that was horrible. You lose friends, you can't communicate with people, you have to hide, basically. Go on the lam. Wasn't quite that bad, you just can't put your head up, that's all. Yeah, it's just difficult. So that's probably it, just cumulative thing, not just one simple, almost got busted, no. It's like there's a whole bunch of those. I remember this guy, he had a delivery of some halide lights, came to his front porch, and the neighborhood dogs chewed up the boxes, and everybody saw he had halide lights, and so he just moved. He moved, he changed houses, he changed, you know. But some really good growers, solution to everything was more light, more watts, you know, that always worked. Even in BC, they had coolers to cool the room. They didn't use air conditioners. They were less expensive. Yeah, and all kinds of weird technology was happening then. Some guys, they had this tubes, I don't know, 4-inch tubes, 4 inches, because they were too little to get your hand in. And then they put a sprinkler in there on a 3/4-inch PVC or with little sprinklers on it. And they had all of this stuff in basements. I saw, you know, a whole bunch of floods, you know, because people didn't have their siphoning stuff sorted, you know. They didn't want them to have, you know, the flood and drain. There's a lot of water in there, and it weighs a lot. And it can all go on the floor, too, if it siphons on you. You don't have any siphon valve. Yeah. Yeah, I saw a lot of stuff, a lot of weird stuff, because a lot of people didn't know what they were doing. Yeah, I mean, and then other people did. They were doing a lot of production as well. Yeah, I mean, it was all over the place. It was all over the place. Now it seems like people are producing like clockwork, you know. It's got much more professional and stuff. And the lighting's like 100% better. You could buy it on Amazon. I looked at 170 websites today. It's amazing how things have changed. I've not looked at so many websites at one time, you know, and like you kind of like keep it in your head. You remember, you start seeing patterns and stuff. And it was just, wow, these guys, they had all kinds of stuff, but there was a lot of repetition too. But man, things look really good. There's a lot of really nice websites, and there's tons of information, and yeah, it was pretty impressive. And I also saw services that offered stuff, you know. And you think about how people are bombarded with emails, but I was looking to see how hard it is to contact these guys, and it's really difficult to find like a way into the website. They make it hard. So that means they get a lot of outside, you know, requests and stuff. And they always set up a format and stuff, you know, for you to contact them. Or not always, but sometimes. It really depends. Yeah, it's much more complex now than it used to be. Before, it used to be, if you're like fucking dumb enough to have a magazine, you know, and put your address in it, you know, and then people would talk to you. So that's what legalization's brought on. It's been much different than, I don't know. I don't know what I expected. You know, it's been illegal so long. When it became legal, it's like, what the fuck? How's this going to work? It took me a year of owning a house before I was in California, and I was perfectly legal before I could actually grow. You know, it was scary. Fucking scary. Because you own the house. That was the scary part. You know, if you didn't own the land, who cares? You know, I mean, just leave. I've got a new book. It's free. It's digital. And it's called We Grow Cannabis. And it's 100 pages. You can download it on your phone, on your computer, or on your tablet or iPad or whatever. And it's like interactive. You can push on any button or any word in the table of contents, and you go to that area. You can do simple searches. It's in a PDF format. You know, you can download it on the seedsman.com site. Yeah. In fact, we're doing it in conjunction with Seedsman, because the deal is, it's hard to make a living selling books. So I decided, well, maybe I can start giving this stuff away and take a different tack. And so I take on the partner with Seedsman, and I've known these guys. I mean, I've known, I don't want to tell everybody's name, Tom, for a long time. And so anyway, we have a good relationship, and we're disseminating information. But it's really quite a nice book. It's got 8 chapters, 270 great color photos. Gosh, what are the chapters? I don't remember right now. Go to seedsman.com. Take a look, and you'll love it. Everything's high quality. Oh, yeah, and I've got two co-authors. They're quite important. I couldn't forget. Dr. Gary Yates. The guy's brilliant. He's amazing. And he's got a degree in microbiology, and he knows tons about breeding, too. Anything science, his mind just kind of works like that. Anyway, he's a great guy. We wrote the book together. He did tons of editing, too. Also, Stefan Meyer. And I've known Stefan forever. Well, it's going to help in the future, but he talks six languages. I mean, I only talk two. He talks six. But anyway, I'm always amazed by that. He's just added tons of stuff. He's got his finger on the pulse of so many things. He started Phytoplant, and they developed about eight different varieties down in Cordoba. Yeah, he's a Swiss guy. Anyway, those are my two co-authors, and Seedsman.com has We Grow Cannabis.